Blog Talk Radio.
Transcendentalist. He began the movement, and I've got a book here, a very old book, but one that I've, it's a pocket book on Emerson that I've carried with me for years, and it's very well underlined, and there's so many passages that I barely. I was looking through it tonight, and I was trying to identify a few things that I might be relevant to what's happening today, and everything is relevant to what's happening today. I've read a number of these essays on the air already, and they're in the archives. But I don't think I've ever really gone through different quotes, to say. And those quotes are from different, a number of different ones. One of the, I don't know if I read this or not before, it's a very short one. Called Spirit, and it's I know I read Idealism, I think I read Discipline, Anger, Its Beauty, but this is one of the shortest essays that I've ever read, and I think I'm going to I have a friend of mine who's an activist, and he been, you know, he was one of the founders of the original founders of Habitat for Humanity. And he writing a book called Spirit. And this is, if there's anybody who has a spirit, it's my buddy Ned. And I'm going to read this by Emerson. It is essential to a true theory of nature and of man that it should contain somewhat progressive uses that are exhausted, or that may be, and facts that end in this statement, cannot be all that is true of this brave lodging wherein man is harbored, wherein all his faculties find appropriate and endless exercise. And all the uses of nature admit of being summed in one, which yields the activity of man in infinite scope, through all its kingdoms, to the suburbs and outskirts of things. It is faithful to the cause whence it had its origin. It always speaks of spirit. It suggests the absolute. It is a perpetual effect. It is a great shadow pointing always to the sun behind us. The aspect of nature is devout, like the figure of Jesus. She stands and bended, neat head and handed, hands folded on the breast. The happiest man is he who learns from nature and lessons of worship. I of that ineffable essence, which we call spirit, he that thinks most will say least. We can foresee God in the course, and as it were, distant phenomena of matter. But when we try to define and describe himself, both language and thought desert us, and we are as helpless as fools and savages. That essence refuses to be recorded in propositions, but when man has worshipped him intellectually, the noblest ministry of nature is to stand as the apparition of God. It is the organ to which the universal spirit speaks to the individual and strives to lead back the individual to it. When we consider spirit, we see that the views already presented do not include the whole circumference of man. We must add some related thoughts. Three problems are put by nature to the mind. What is matter? Whence is it? And where to? The first of these questions only the ideal theory answers. Idealism saith, matter is a phenomenon, not a substance. Idealism acquaints us with the total disparity between the evidence of our own being and the evidence of the world's being. The one is perfect, the other incapable of any assurance. And the mind is a part of the nature of things. The world is the divine dream from which we may presently awake to the glories and certainties of day. Idealism is a hypothesis to account for nature by other principles than those of carpentry and chemistry. Yet if it only deny the existence of matter, it does not satisfy the demands of the spirit. It leaves God out of me. It leaves me in the splendid labyrinth of my perceptions to wander without end. Then the heart resists it, because it balks the affections in denying substantial being to men and women. Nature is so pervaded with human life that there is something of humanity in all and in every particular. But this theory makes nature foreign to me and does not account for that consanguinity which we acknowledge to it. Let it stand, then, in the present state of our knowledge, merely as a useful introductory hypothesis, serving to apprise us of the eternal distinction between the soul and the world. But when following the invisible steps of thought, we come to inquire, whence is matter, and where to? Many truths arise to us out of the recesses of consciousness. We learn that the highest is present to the soul of man, that the dread universal essence, which is not wisdom or love or beauty or power, but all in one and each entirely, is that for which all things exist, and that by which they are, that spirit creates, that behind nature, throughout nature, spirit is present, one and not compound. It does not act upon us from without, that is, in space and time, but spiritually or through ourselves. Therefore, the spirit, that is, the supreme being, does not build up nature around us, but puts it forth through us, as the life of the tree puts forth new branches and leaves through the pores of the old. As a plant upon the earth, so a man rests upon the bosom of God. He is nourished by unfailing fountains and draws at his need inexhaustible power. And who can set bounds to the possibilities of man? Once inhale the upper air, being admitted to behold the absolute natures of justice and truth, and we learn that man has access to the entire mind of the Creator, is himself the Creator in the finite. This view, which admonishes me where the sources of wisdom and power lie, the points and points to virtue, as to the golden key which opts the place of eternity. The palace of eternity, and carries upon its face the highest certificate of truth, because it animates me to create my own world through the purification of my soul. The world proceeds from the same spirit as the body of man. It is a remoter and inferior incarnation of man, a projection of God in the consciousness, but it differs from the body in one important respect. It is not like that now subjected to the human will. Its serene order is inviolable by us. It is therefore to us the presenter, expositor of the divine mind. It is a fixed point thereby we may measure our departure. As we degenerate, the contrast between us and our house is more evident. We are as much strangers as nature, in nature as we are aliens from God. We do not understand the notes of birds. The fox and the deer run away from us. The bear and tiger rend us. We do not know the uses of more than a few plants as corn and apple, the potato and the vine. Is not the landscape every glimpse of which hath grandeur, a face of him? Yet this may show us what discord is between man and nature. For you cannot freely admire a noble landscape if laborers are digging in the field hard by. The poet finds something ridiculous in his delight until he is out of the sight of men. That's the end of that essay, and I thought it was important to bring it up because it leads to all of his other work. And, you know, we have a spirit, and that spirit is, you know, defines us, defines who we are. And I read last week, this book called You Are a Spiritual Being Having a Human Experience. And we definitely are that. I mean, there can be no doubt. You know, we're a spirit having a human experience. I believe that. Only because this existence is totally irrational. It makes absolutely no sense. To live and to die, you know. It's just too strange. And it would be one thing if we were, I guess, like animals and didn't realize that we were going to die, you know. You just live in the moment. future, and mostly we live in the future, contemplating each next move that we make. It's like a chess game, you know, or a checker game. You know, what's your next move? You know? And struggling to offset in the future move what's the bad moves you made in the present. Trying to juxtapose those events to some degree, and to, you know, but fate has a way of screwing you up. You know, you just can't. Fate just destroys you. You know, or it can elevate you. You know, but you can't deny fate. It's due, you know. It's like any moment. I could, you know, I think of this since I was just hospitalized recently, and but I think of how sudden illness can come on, and death can come on. And for God's sakes, if you're in the battlefield or, you know, anything, you know, one day you're fine, next day you're dead, you know. Next minute you're dead. Or you're talking to a guy, and the next minute he's shot in the head. These are things that just boggle the mind, you know. And you never get off that. You never, you know, you never write after that. And it's the same way when you have an illness. You don't understand. And first thing you think about is, you know, well, what did I do wrong? Or what did I do to? What did I eat or drink or do to create this disease? How did I get it? You know? But all of that actually is irrelevant to the point where you're facing death and you're trying to recuperate. Rather than have regrets or remorse over what happened, you're just, you know, frantically trying to get better. You know, putting all your attention to the focusing on, you know, that area or, you know, the illness. But trying to keep a positive attitude. Trying not to think too much about why it happened, but trying to think of how to get better. That's fate. You know, it's everything that happens is that way. It seems like we're constantly struggling in the spirit somehow. And it is. It's a totally intangible concept, the spirit. But at the same time, our thoughts are intangible. They just are thoughts. They just come and go and fleet. And, you know, you unless you write them down and publish them, you can't prove that you had them, you know. Can't prove to anybody, even to yourself. You know? So, what I'm trying to say is that though we live in a third-dimensional existence, a universe, we are not from here. We are not third-dimensional beings. We're simply, you know, having a third-dimensional existence as spirits. Because if we weren't, how could we rationalize the creation of this spirit? The preternatural knowledge that we have, even as infants, to know to cry or to know to, you know, laugh or, you know, what's funny or what's not funny or why do certain things strike us or why is love so present even at the moment of, you know, and if love is denied us as infants, then we grow up with bonding issues and we can't, and we can't bond to anyone. We have difficulty. So, I don't know. It's a question that I have questioned all my life. You know, but I get closer and closer and closer to the answer as I get closer and closer and closer to myself. If that's even possible. And I refuse to believe that that if I die, I won't live on in some other dimension. And this is something that we create as human beings. We co-create our existence here in the third dimension, but also in the fourth and fifth dimensions, in the higher dimensions. We must think first that we of them, and then try to transcend ourselves to those thought patterns. And once we do, then just as everything in life, you think it and it happens, you know. As a man thinketh, so is he. So what does that make me? I don't know. I thinketh man. But am I any better off for thinking, or am I better just being a deaf, dumb, and blind, you know, without any mental process and just, you know, institutionalized as an idiot? You know, that's who's better off, the thinking man or the idiot? You know, sometimes I question that. I wanted to, part of the answers I'm going to relate tonight, Emerson has already thought through. And one paragraph here in, several paragraphs actually, I'm going to read in his essay on self-reliance. And I want to read just the opening short stanzas or poem. Man is his own star, and the soul that can render an honest and perfect man commands all light, all influence, all fate. Nothing to him falls early or too late. Our acts, our angels are, or good or ill, our fatal shadows that walk by us still. Cast the bantling on the rocks, suckle him with the she-wolf's teat, wintered with the hawk and fox, power and speed be hands and feet. Now I'm going to move on here to selected paragraphs out of this essay. Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to the iron string. Accept the place the divine providence has found for you, the society of your contemporaries, the connection of events. Great men have always done so, and confided themselves childlike to the genius of their age, betraying their perception that the absolute trustworthy was seated at their heart, working through their hands, predominating in all their being. And they are now men, and must accept in the highest mind the same transcendent destiny, and not minors and invalids in a protected corner, not cowards fleeing before a revolution, but guides, redeemers and benefactors obeying the almighty effort and advancing on chaos and the dark. And that's what we are. That's really what we are. You know, we just keep advancing. we keep advancing. And we constantly, before revolutions, and but we're guides and we're redeemers and benefactors, obeying the almighty effort and advancing on chaos and the dark. And it's through our faith and through our confidence, that our own personal confidence and courage, that we continue through the chaos and the dark. And this is part of our self-reliance. This is part of our spirit. This is part of our inherent spirit connected to the universal spirit, to God. Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather immortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must explore it to be goodness, if it be goodness, rather. And nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind. And absolve you to yourself, and you shall have the suffrage of the world. Yeah. No law. Well, let me start here. I love this segment because it's so profane. I remember an answer which, when I quite young, I was prompted to make to a valued advisor who was wont to importune me with the dear old doctrines of the church. On my saying, "What have I to do with the sacredness of traditions if I live wholly from within?" my friend suggested, "But these impulses may be from below, not from above." And I replied, "They do not seem to me to be such, but if I am the devil's child, I will live them from the devil, and no law shall be sacred to me but that of my nature." Wow, that's a statement, because especially to be made by a guy in 1835 or so, you know. But good and bad are but names, very readily transferable to that or this. The only right is what is after my constitution. The only wrong, what is against it. And a man is to carry himself in the presence of all opposition as if everything were titular and ephemeral to but he. I am ashamed to think how easy we capitulate to badges and names, to large societies and dead institutions. Every decent and well-spoken individual affects and sways me more than is right. I ought to go upright and vital, and speak the rude truths in all ways. If malice and vanity wear the coat of philanthropy, shall that pass? If an angry bigot assumes this bountiful cause of abolition and comes to me with his last news from Barbados, why should I not say to him, "Go love thy infant, love thy woodchopper, be good-natured and modest, have the grace, and never varnish your hard, uncharitable ambition with this incredible tenderness for the black folk who are 1,000 miles off. Thy love affair is spite at home. Rough and graceless would be such greeting, but truth is handsomer than the affection of love. Your goodness must have some edge to it, else it is none. The doctrine of hatred must be preached as the counteraction of the doctrine of love. And when that punes and whines, I shun father and mother and wife and brother when my genius calls me. I would write to the lintels of the doorpost, whim. I hope it is somewhat better than whim at last. But we cannot spend the day in explanation, except expect me not to show cause why I seek or why I exclude company. Then again, do not tell me, as a good man did today, of my obligation to put all poor men in good situations. Are they my poor? I'll tell thee, thou foolish philanthropist, that I grudge the dollar, the dime, the cent I give to such men as do not belong to me, and to whom I do not belong. There is a class of persons to whom, by all spiritual affinity, I am bought and sold. For them I will go to prison if need be. But your miscellaneous popular charities, the education of College of Fools, the building of meeting houses, the vain end to which many now stand, alms to sots, and the thousands-fold relief societies, though I confess with shame I sometimes succumb to give the dollar, it is a wicked dollar, which by and by I shall have the manhood to withhold. And that's a statement that I don't know if I agree with that. So, because I believe in charities. I believe that charities are extremely important. Homeless shelters and things, because people are in tough times. The world doesn't exist in the same way that it did back in the 1800s. And ever since day when, you know, everybody was, everybody, you know, people worked and had land to work. They grew their own foods. They added, you know, things. They didn't have inflation. They didn't have things that were stealing from them, other than robber barons and stuff like that. But they have. But society today has taken away much of the ability of men and women to fend for themselves. They are employed by somebody. They are employers of somebody. They are they have a massive government that they never had before. They have massive involvements in other countries that we never had before. Trillions of our taxpayer dollars are going to foreign wars, and that you never had that kind of money before being thrown at, for just thrown away. I often wonder what Emerson would say today about our political system and about our the insanity of our ways here in this country. He wouldn't recognize it. You'd be disgusted by it. And but I keep believing that he would be doing what we are doing, you know, now, trying to, what I'm doing now, trying to explain these truths to the world, you know, trying to explain them to audience 1, 2, 10, 1,000, 500, whatever the audience may be. That listens to shows that I put out. I want to move on to a few other quotes. What I must do is all that concerns me, not what the people think. This rule, equally arduous in an actual and an intellectual life, may serve for the whole distinction between greatness and meanness. It is the heartier because you will always find those who think they know what is your duty better than you know it. And it is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great men or man is he who is in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. And we do that. We do that ourselves. Most people do. But I get rather rattled in cities. I get rattled in malls. I get rattled where many, many people are congregated doing all kinds of things. And I don't get that problem when you go someplace like a protest, where people are there for a purpose and there to, you know, for a reason. But I get agitated and uncomfortable in large crowds of ambient movement, you know, thought, where there's no real unified thought at all, other than to shop, you know, or to drive home, you know, you're in a massive rush hour or something, you know, and these things lead to irritability, you know, on my part, as I'm sure it would on many people's part. But to me, there's nothing more calming, more enjoyable than being with myself in solitude. Being in solitude, being able to read, or being able to write, or being able to create music, or being able to draw or paint or whatever it may be. But in order to conduct some personal enrichment, if you will, even simple meditation, you know, to be able just to close your eyes and meditate for a few minutes, to calm yourself down and bring yourself back into reality, you know, with a higher consciousness, you know, so you're able to cope with whatever, you know, nightmare is or whatever is happening. You can't stop the weather, you know, you can't stop that. You can't stop certain things, but the one thing you can stop is yourself. You can't stop others, you can only stop yourself. And sometimes that's even very difficult to do. Stop yourself. Or to get yourself going again. The objection to conforming to usages that have become dead to you is that it scatters your force. It loses your time and blurs the impression of your character. If you maintain a dead church, contribute to dead Bible societies, vote with a great party, either for the government or against it, spread your table like base housekeepers, under all these screens, I have difficulty to detect the precise man you are. And of course, so much force is withdrawn from your proper life. But do your work, and I shall know you. Do your work and you shall reinforce yourself. A man must consider what a blind man's bluff is, this game of conformity. If I know your sect, I anticipate your argument. I hear a preacher announce for his next text and topic the expediency of one of the institutions of his church. Do I not know beforehand that not possibly can he say a new and spontaneous word? Do I not know that with all this ostentation of examining the grounds of the institution, he will do no such thing? And do I not know that he is pledged to himself not to look but at one side, the permitted side, not as a man, but as a parish minister? He is a retained attorney, and these heirs of the bench are emptiest affectation. Will most men abound their eyes with one or another handkerchief and attach themselves to some one of these communities of opinion? This conformity makes them not false and in a few particulars authors of a few lies, but false in all particulars. Their every truth is not quite true. Their two is not the real two. Their four is not the real four. So that every word they say chagrins us, and we know not where to begin to set them right. In meantime, nature is not slow to equip us in the prison uniform of the party to which we adhere. And we come to wear a one cut of face and figure, and acquire by degrees the gentlest asinine expressions. And there is a mortifying experience in particular, which does not fail to wreck itself on also in the general hot history. I mean the foolish face of praise, the forced smile which we must put on in company where we do not feel at ease, in answer to conversation which does not interest us, the muscles not spontaneously moved, but moved by a low, usurping willfulness, grow tight along the outlining of the face and the most disagreeable sensations. And for nonconformity, the world whips you with its displeasure, and therefore a man must know how to estimate a sour face, and the bystander also askance to him in the street on the friend or in a friend's parlor, or this aversion had its origin in contempt and resistance like his own, he might well go home with a sad countenance. But the sour faces of the multitude, like their sweet faces, have no deep cause, but are put on and off as the winds blow and the newspapers direct. Yet in the discontent of the multitude, more formidable than that of the Senate and the College, it is easy enough for a firm man who knows the world to brook the rage of the cultivated classes. Their rage is decorous and prudent, for they are blind, or they are timid, as being very vulnerable themselves. But when to their feminine rage, the indignation of the people is added, when the ignorant and the poor are aroused, then when the unintelligent brute force that lies at the bottom of society is made to growl and mow, it needs the habit of magnanimity and the religion to treat it godlike as a trifle of no concernment. The other terror that scares us from self-trust is our consistency, a reverence of our past act or word, because the eyes of others have no other data for computing our orbit than our past acts, and we are loath to disappoint them. This is a lot of heavy stuff here in this particular passage that I just read. And being a nonconformist all my life, I certainly understand how the world whips you and its displeasure with its displeasure. like everybody's supposed to wear gray, you know. Everybody's supposed to be gray and conform to the thought process and of whatever it is that you're supposed to think. And the news speak of the day, you know, the newspapers, if you will. I gave up reading newspapers and mainstream media reports many years ago, just because I found them to be all the same trite crap, you know. Always censored, all buried news, all propaganda. So I had to start looking for alternative sources of information and being able to verify those sources as semi-accurate. And I found that most of those sources were more accurate than what was being presented in the mainstream media by the networks or by the on radio or reporting agencies and so on. And that became part of the self-reliant aspect of my education, you know, not depending on others, not depending on the thoughts of others to generate my thoughts or to support my thoughts It wasn't until I discovered men like Ralph Emerson, who cared not for what anybody said. You know, he thought for himself, and he insisted that other people think for themselves. And he got into many, many arguments with people over those concepts. And, you know, for instance, one of the greatest issues during his time was abolition and the freedom of the slaves. And though he was slow to move into the fray, into the abolitionist movement, because of fear, basically, you know, most were rather, and society was so entrenched in the concepts of slavery, and that injustice was so prevailing, not only in this country, but around the world, that it was kind of ingrained in your mind. But it wasn't until you had radicals like Lloyd Garrison, or the Quakers, or the, you know, people who you know, were consistently in the face of the public, decrying the horrors of slavery and the abuses of slavery, and the, you know, that all men should be free, and the hypocrisy of the of our Constitution, or our free, you know, Declaration of Independence, you know, that all men are created equal, you know. So, you know, that prevailing hypocrisy was all part and parcel of what men like Emerson had to look at and had to face eventually, and men of conscience had to face and say, no, we're living an illusion here. We can't, I can't allow this to happen without saying something. And he became an avid revolutionary, an avid abolitionist, joined the movement. But the but in some ways, in a passive way, it was, he was, he got into it slowly and tried to be polite when other radicals were not polite and refused to be polite in the face of such atrocities, you know, that were happening in the, you know, with slavery, which, you know, enough through the works of Emerson and others led to the emancipation of blacks, you know, to that thought process, to that enlightenment of that society, causing a civil war, unfortunately, but nevertheless, these were warring times. You know, we had fought in a war to free ourselves in a revolution, and now we're fighting in a war to free our slaves, to free the slaves, to free a race of people. And that we're still fighting that war, and those people and blacks are fighting it alongside of us. And, you know, we, to the extent that we, and I believe we've become victorious, because we do have an elected black president. So abolitionists would be amazed, you know, you know, so would Martin Luther King and other people that fought so hard, you know, for the rights of people. But I'm digressing here a bit, and but I wanted to say this because it's the nonconformist, it's the radical, thinker, all right, that moves society, one person at a time, small group at a time, you know, until it ignites, you know, a movement, right? And that's how it works. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, adored by little statesmen and philosophers and divines. With consistency, a great soul has simply nothing to do. He may as well concern himself with his shadow on the wall. Speak what you think now in hard words, and tomorrow speak what you tomorrow thinks in hard words again, though it contradict everything you said today. Ah, so you shall be sure to be misunderstood. Is it so bad then to be misunderstood? Pythagoras was misunderstood. Socrates and Jesus and Luther and Copernicus and Galileo and Newton and every pure and wise spirit that ever took flesh. To be great is to be misunderstood. I suppose no man can violate his nature. All the sallies of his will are rounded in by the law of his being, as the inequalities of Andes and Himalaya are insignificant in the curve of the sphere. Nor does it matter how you gauge and try him. A character is like an anachronistic or Alexandrian stanza. Read it forward, backward, or across, and it still spells the same thing. In this pleasing, contrite woodlife which God allows me, let me record day by day my honest thought without prospect or retrospect, and I cannot doubt it will be found symmetrical, though I mean it not and see it not. My book should smell of pines and resound with the hum of insects. The shadow over my window should interweave with threads or straw he carries in his bill into my web also. And we pass for what we are. Character teaches above all our wills. Men imagine that they communicate their virtue or vice, but by overt actions. Only by overt actions. And do not see the virtue or vice emit a breath every moment. And that's so true. You know, that's so true. A man's character is ever present. It's ever present. What he likes or dislikes, how he acts or reacts to any event, how he speaks, if he lies to you, if he cheats you, if he beats you, if he yells at you, or if he laughs at you, or if he, you know, or if he has, or if his character is jovial, or if his character is compassionate, you can see this in every single, and you can feel it. But the problem is that most people want to believe the best, or they don't even want to spend that much time thinking. They just think that, you know, and they accept the authority of their religion, or be it Catholic or Muslim or Jewish or whatever faith, or they accept the thoughts of the Democratic Party, a Republican Party, a Libertarian Party, or the Green Party, or the Socialist Party, the Conservative Party, or whatever the hell party you're in. Rather than think for yourself, you immediately tag yourself to these, whatever, and maybe to some extent you attract, if you're a politician, you need some form of party, otherwise you'll be, you'll never make it. So you create your own party and get your own followers, you know, like Twitter or something, you know, or Facebook. And, you know, these are the ways that you create political friction, you know, create political awareness, is by starting your own party, you know, starting your own thought process. And whatever that thought process is, you'll find that it will attract others, like-minded people, so that what you are fighting for or fighting with will be enhanced by the many who will fight with you, okay? But always, always, always strive to be sincere and honest and always seeking the truth. And unfortunately, in politics and what government and so on, that's immediately quashed out of you. So, but except for the few hardliners, the few hard fighting people, men and women, the Ron Pauls, for instance, the Paul Wellstones, the JFKs and Bobby Kennedys, and people who fought for their principles and died for their principles. So, for my principles and live a slave or a coward. I can say that because I believe, as I started this program, that we are spirit, and we're spirits having a human experience. That's been proven time and time and time again by countless millions and billions of billions and possibly trillions of people who have lived on this earth and died, and have gone off, either reincarnated or merged into another dimension and remained there, or moved on, you know, in their infinite and eternal spirit to other higher realms in the hierarchy of existence. So, with those words, I'm going to leave you tonight, I guess. And I'm going to, I guess, still get a few more minutes. And I'd like to see if I get anything else here that I underline that I can leave you with. There's so many profound statements made by Emerson that it's almost impossible not to have a few favorites. Let a Stoic open the resources of man and tell men they are not leaning willows, but can and must detach themselves, that with the exercise of self-trust, new powers shall appear. That a man is the Word made flesh, born to shed healing to the nations, that he should be ashamed of our compassion, and that the moment he acts upon himself, tossing the laws, the books, idolatries, and customs out of the window, we pity him no more, but thank and revere him. And that teacher shall restore to the life of man to splendor and make his name dear to all history. Yes. It is easier to see that a greater self-reliance must work a revolution in all the offices and relations of men, in their religion, in their education, and in their pursuits, their modes of living, their associations and their property, in their speculative views. In prayer, in what prayer do men allow themselves? That which they can call a holy office is not so much as brave and manly. Prayer looks abroad and asks for some foreign addition to come through some foreign virtue, and loses itself in the endless maze of natural and supernatural and mediatorial and miraculous. Prayer that craves a particular commodity, anything less than all good, is vicious. And prayer is the contemplation of the facts of life from the highest point of view. It is the soliloquy of a beholding and jubilant soul, and it is the Spirit of God pronouncing his works good. But a prayer is a means to effect the private ends, meaningless and theft. It supposes dualism and not unity in nature and consciousness. As soon as the man is at one with God, he will not beg. He will then see prayers in all actions. And with that, I'm going to leave you tonight. And his hidden meaning lies in our endeavors, and our valors are our best gods. And I urge you to pick up a copy and read our vote to RWE, Ralph Waldo Emerson.org, RWE.org, and all of his works are there. And you can pick them up online for all for free. So I highly suggest you do that. And I wish you a good evening and a good weekend. And we won't be back till next Tuesday night. So please enjoy this show and tell your friends. And also, please go to our past shows. I have over 500 of them here on the archives. So enjoy, and I thank you, and have a pleasant evening.
Thank you.